Welcome to a new episode of the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and today we're going to take a look at Razer's recipe for success. The Razer Group buys, or started to buy, Amazon FBA businesses. By now, it feels a bit more like you're buying FBA aggregators, like other companies that did the same that you did in the beginning, and you consolidate them and build a group of e-commerce brands. As you as a listener might know, these aggregator models were very hyped during 2020 and 2021. Then the cost of capital came up, and now it feels like a bit of the anti-hype at the moment. And therefore, I'm very happy to discuss with Razer Group founder Tusha Ahluwalia the good and bad sides of building and scaling, rapidly scaling during a hype cycle, and the future of Amazon aggregator businesses, and a lot more. You started in 2020, funny enough, in the backyard of my studio's address here in Berlin. That's also how we met. You raised more than $1 billion in funding, recently acquired Perch to become the largest aggregator measured by revenue, and you have approximately 450 people working at the Razer Group. Tusha, welcome back to the origin of Razer, and welcome to the Unicorn Bakery.
Thank you, Fabian, for having me, and it, you know, gives me a lot of old memories coming back into the building. And as we just discussed, remember the early days at Razer Group, which have been quite intense, and everybody loves to think about those moments. And so hope you know, this will give us some good luck and energy for this podcast.
It's not even 4 years ago that you started, so it's been a hell of a ride, like from one of the most hyped companies in Berlin to one of the most like anti-hyped companies in Berlin, I guess.
It's a very nice word.
Yeah, so I'm not the person to make headlines here. Yeah. So how would you describe the last 4 years?
Intense. I think, you know, you've... going through different cycles, going through, you know, the good moments, the tough moments, and moving forward, I think has been extremely, I'd say, helpful to, I'd say, also develop as a human being. And with all of the team members, you know, it probably was as extreme as you think. So...
You said it's probably as extreme as I and all the listeners would think. What would you say are the good parts about scaling as fast as you did? I mean, you, as I said, you raised $1 billion in capital. I'm not sure if all is equity or if that is combined equity and
external. Across equity dollars and debt dollars. You know, I think, you know, as we discussed right now, I don't know if it's really a dilemma. Whether, you know, you can say it was good or it was bad, was just a choice that we took to build that business. We were excited about the business. We are still excited about the business. And so that's a path we went down. We had access to that capital. And so, you know, once we've chosen that path, we embrace that path. And that path comes with benefits. It comes with disadvantages for founders in terms of control, but it comes with benefits of having very smart people that you build a business together with. It allows you to build defining companies in a much more rapid way. So I think, you know, comes with both advantages and disadvantages. But again, I think the team, the founding team that has eventually went on to build Razer, also over the last couple of quarters and years, is a founding team that I'd say is more in the venture bucket, right? So this is our DNA. We want to build large companies. We want to make a difference. You know, we don't want to flip shit, or, you know, we want to build an institution that's meaningful in size and something great. And I think you can do that much better with... I'd say the ecosystem supporting you to build such an institution, a large business. So for us, I think it was never a choice. Do we build Razer Group that way or this way? And obviously it's a capital-led model, but we were always inclined to build something with the venture or capital ecosystem in Berlin together, and that's what we did.
Let's talk about the founding team. I mean, I think it was easy to foresee that this will be a hell of a ride, but I'm not sure if it's foreseeable, like, how crazy it will be, like,
yeah,
how quickly, how, like, everything that happens. But you decide for what you want to build. Who do you pick as the founding team? What made the, in quotation marks, perfect Razer founding team?
So for me, you know, and I chose a lot of the co-founders to, you know, be on this journey with. One of the most important things for me is that there is some sort of loyalty between founding team members, because obviously I've been building businesses before that. So I'm not a first-time founder. My last business that I built in India, and, you know, I was in India for a long time, although I was born and raised in Dusseldorf, Germany, you know, gave me some insight and some experience. And one of those insights is that, you know, there are tough moments as you build a business, whether you want it or not, right? So building a business that scales fast, and the kind of business that we built, it's clear that, you know, there will be extreme highs and there will be some lows that you'll need to tackle. And having a team that can fully trust each other, I think, is a prerequisite. This is sort of the DNA of the team. So that, you know, sort of loyalty on one end, loyalty, trust, big trust, near blind trust almost, right? Within sort of, you know, not completely blind trust. Obviously, you need to see that, you know, you do everything by the book, but like very, very heavy duty trust and loyalty on the one end. And then on the other side, what has really helped us is complementarity of skill set. So we are not sort of the same skill set at all. So it's not like we have three people from McKinsey, everybody studied at WAU, or everybody studied at TUM. And so now that's sort of the boxed founding team that is amazing, and you can, you know, let's go and we roll with that. In fact, you know, you have different personalities, such as Shrestha, who I know from my time in India. She's a Stanford computer science alumna, so handles a lot of the technology in our business, which has been a key competitive advantage of ours. You have Chris Gammon, who I know through the Rocket Internet ecosystem. So I worked within the Rocket ecosystem, obviously, previously. And so he is sort of more of a banker kind of personality type, or of an Excel guy. Shrestha is more of a Python person. And you have Olli, who I know from my high school in Düsseldorf, who is a physicist. And so everybody comes sort of with different traits, different personalities. And sort of we're able to work well with each other. And I think that has been defining for us as we maneuvered different episodes in our young history. We are, I think, 3.5 years old now, but obviously have seen quite the extremes with 2021 and then a complete flip in market, in macroeconomics. And so maneuvering that period has been possible because of a strong team that is both very, very trusting with each other and has a complementarity and skill set, so you can handle different things simultaneously. So that has been, I think, that worked well for us, and that's what I looked for as I put together the team. These are all people that I know for ages. Olli I know from high school, Shrestha I know from my time in India, and Chris I know through the Rocket Internet ecosystem. So I think there's always been some history with the people that I've then chosen to work with, and who have also chosen to work with me. And I think that has been instrumental in forming the founding team that we have.
Take me through some of the first days. I mean, you had the founding team, so you're not a solo founder. You didn't have to do everything on your own. It's like you had a team. You could split up the tasks. You needed capital, and you wanted to buy companies that were running on Amazon FBA. So how Like, did you start creating deal flow while you were fundraising? Were you fundraising first? Like, how were the first steps going to create momentum to then also being able to, like, figuring out, okay, what businesses do we want to buy? Where do we get the money from? How many businesses are we going to buy for phase one until we need to raise another round?
Yeah. The truth is, I think a lot of the early stage investors and supporters and angels that we ended up partnering with were folks that, you know, I knew and I was in touch with. So they were part of the ecosystem. So it's not like I cold called them. There was an existing relationship. And so you had sort of the existing relationship with early stage capital, also early stage capital that was excited to work with me, and I was excited to work with them on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you obviously had sort of, you know, the team, you had sort of our interest in building something in consumer on the other hand. So it was, I'd say, it was not sort of this romantic piece where, you know, I woke up and said, hey, I have a idea in the middle of the night, and you know, I think I'm going to build this big aggregator. It was definitely not that case, but I think there were a couple of components that came together. One is, and that I'm speaking mid-2020, I knew e-commerce. I've had large e-commerce businesses before and ran large e-commerce businesses before. I had an ecosystem that was keen to do something together with me, both on the co-founder side and on the capital side. And then you sort of obviously had market signals that at that point were validating the largest player. Of course, today we are the largest player. And that sort of putting that sort of mix together allowed us to then kick off in, I'd say, August 2020. And that's sort of how the coming about of Razor Group has happened. That was sort of... you know, both existing relationships, a little bit of idea, a little bit of luck, a little bit of, you know, let's do it. And so that then propelled us to start the business in August of 2020.
How many businesses have you bought by now? When we talk about you as a Razor Group buying single brands like FBA businesses,
yeah,
and then also ending the single businesses that other aggregators that you acquired had on.
So I would really, you know, and, you know, you wanted to speak a little bit about sort of the backdrop of macroeconomic factors. And so I'd really say there, you know, there are two Razor Groups. One is, I'd say, the pre-2022 Razor Group or pre-2021 Razor Group that was a product of the market environment then. And then there is, I'd say, a post-2022 Razor Group. And the strategy has, I'd say, has been quite different in those different phases, which is a pure function of how markets have behaved. And so in financial markets, but also consumer markets, right? And so we are in the intersection of the two. I'd say Razor 1.0 was a lot about, you know, was a classic buy and build strategy, but for the internet. So it was sort of, you know, 50% internet, 50% private equity kind of setup, where you took on acquisition capital and used that acquisition capital to deploy in acquisitions of these FBA merchants. And FBA merchants were particularly attractive because obviously they're very easy to sort of operate. They're not as complex. A lot of the operational complexity is taken away by Amazon, who handle your logistics, who handle your e-commerce operations. And so you can very easily, you know, acquire many of those FBA businesses, unlock synergies, and operate these businesses. And so I'd say this, together with, I'd say, a COVID-induced tailwind for these businesses, together with, I'd say, a low interest rate regime, a ZIRP environment, provided sort of a perfect breeding ground for sort of this aggressive buy and build strategy where, you know, you saw many players pop up and raise acquisition capital to buy these businesses and operationalize them. I'd say that is sort of aggregator 1.0. And obviously, sort of markets changed in 22, quite tremendously so. And so, which we obviously in hindsight regard as the perfect storm, wherein on the capital side, you know, things flipped. I think one of the reasons was probably the post-COVID period that came with sort of supply shocks, and supply shocks together with sort of a lot of cash that was with consumers, you know, triggered, you know, massive sort of inflationary pressures. And as a consequence, central banks had to react and sort of increase interest rates. So there was sort of a perfect storm. Many, many things happened in 2022. Interest rates increased. Consumer multiples got compressed. You know, there were supply chain shocks on the consumer side. You had a, you're coming out of post-COVID, and so you're comparing to a COVID period. And so it was an interesting period. And so all of these companies that sort of were operating under the assumption of a 2021 environment were faced with a crazy macroeconomic, dramatic shift in macroeconomic, in macros and macroeconomic elements. And so as a consequence, you know, we realized that the path forward for us is not this traditional roll-up, but really focusing on consolidating smaller players and other players who collectively are experiencing the same headwinds. And so that is when we shifted our focus of what we want to acquire, which was essentially other players. And so what you see Razor Group acquire since the second half of 2022 are our peers, starting with Factory 14, then Valoreo, who was the leader in Latin America, the Strice Group, which I think was the second or third largest player in Berlin. And that's now culminating, obviously, in the acquisition of Puig. And so really, you know, when we speak about Razor Group, we need to see sort of there is a 2021 Razor Group that has then emerged from a 2022 environment as sort of the consolidator of consolidators. That's sort of what we, you know, how I think about it, how the people at Razor Group think about it.
How did your role as a leader change before and after the market dynamic changed?
I think, you know, the role has always, you know, been, has always been changing with the rapid scale. So, you know, as a small business, you know, obviously, you know, I was much, much more hands-on. I'm still very hands-on. But obviously, as things change and there's so much change in the organization driven by external factors, you know, I think the people aspect becomes increasingly important, and managing the different stakeholders to make sure that everybody's aligned on the vision, on where we are headed. And so execution doesn't suffer. And so, you know, my sort of role was very different in different quarters, I'd say. So a lot of the time that I spent, for example, in the last 3-4 quarters was making sure strategic deals such as the Perch deal happen. And, you know, there are stakeholders involved that I need to work with to make sure that, you know, that transaction was a successful one for Razor Group, which it was and ended up being. So a lot of the time, I'd say, in the last couple of quarters was really on the strategic M&A side. It'll continue to be more on, I'd say, strategic deals. But obviously, as I look over the next couple of quarters, you know, a lot of focus will also be on, you know, operations, executions, and also getting in the right talent to make sure the company continues to raise ahead and progress and grows fast.
I will ask you about the Perch deal a bit later, but before, I think we need to understand the dynamic a bit better of why those other aggregators wanted or needed to sell. Like,
yeah,
because I think it's very clear that we're turning from a good cash environment to a not good cash environment for cash heavy businesses. And you,
well, things are improving now again. Bitcoin is going up again.
After,
it's a good sign.
talking 2022 that you already mentioned and described very well.
Yeah.
One of the underlying hypotheses of these aggregator models was, okay, we're buying cash efficient businesses that are profitable, and we are able to build out more and more synergies. That means we can run them with or put them together, have even more margin, and then run a business that's like worthwhile.
Yeah.
What happened to the aggregators that you bought, for example?
Before I answer that question, there's one thing that I really need to say, which is that I'm not a fan of the word aggregator. Obviously, I understand we are now bucketed in that, or all companies that have emerged from, I'd say, this credit-led M&A cycle in 2021 are called aggregators. But aggregation is not a business. Aggregation is a strategy. It's an inorganic strategy wherein you acquire other businesses. But, you know, it's not the soul or the purpose of your business. It's not the consumer of your business. You know, your target company that you acquire is not your customer. Your customer is the end consumer. It's the customer that is buying your product.
Do we call it consolidator then, or what's the better word?
For Razor Group, you know, we're probably a product-led e-commerce powerhouse. That's probably how I would call it, because obviously our history has been a lot of roll-up, and our DNA and our capabilities are obviously very good in the M&A and also now in the consolidation complex M&A structuring and on the deal side. But our future and our present is creating amazing consumer products, because this is sort of, you know, the future of our business. Obviously, you know, M&A will always be close as an engine for growth, for inorganic growth. But what's the real world delta that we generate beyond just M&A, right? What's the real world impact? And the real world impact is and has to be making consumers' lives better by providing better consumer product.
The question was, what made it so hard for all the other companies that bought Amazon FBA businesses to survive? Is it the cost of capital? Is it because it's harder to run and consolidate those businesses? What are the points that, for example, a Perch and also others were selling to you?
You know, I think there are two elements. I think Razor is incredibly good at its technology infrastructure and operationalizing. Our bet to very early on have somebody like Tresha and our team who has worked with, and I'd say, top tier talent to build out the automation use cases, the automation stack, as we say, to be able to scale a business such as ours, because obviously it's incredibly complex to operate so many different products and so many different SKUs that you have ingested through M&A and making sort of the trains run on time. I think that has really helped us to position ourselves as sort of the prime candidate for consolidation. Second, I'd say the market environment obviously also pushed players to consider M&A and consolidation, and specifically, you know, it's probably, you know, all of the items that I explained right now, all of the above. So whether that's, you know, interest rates, whether that's sort of outlook on the operations of their own portfolios and the businesses that they have operated to consider consolidating and selling to Razor Group. And the third is obviously, you know, in a phase like this where markets have shifted 180 degrees, you know, scale is an important factor. Because it has, you know, many repercussions in terms of, you know, your ability to maneuver the current market environment. So I think these three reasons would, you know, then lead these businesses to, you know, join hands with Razor Group. in obviously, you know, investors in these companies already also know. And, you know, I think everybody in the ecosystem knows each other. And so, you know, these elements would have ensured that, you know, those transactions then eventually happened as they did. Right.
Knowing that those are all the reasons why I would decide for Razor, I think the main question still is, why do I have to decide for another company? Because if I would be profitable and I'm running a profitable company,
yeah,
no matter how many brands I call it, what makes me sell this company?
Because you're not profitable. I mean, what? Because you're profitable at EBITDA, but you're not profitable at net income, right? So I think what goes missing in these discussions right now is obviously capital structure. These companies have debt, and obviously debt that is more probably that's better in a 2021 environment versus in a 2022 environment, right? So I think a lot of the debt that was raised in a 2021 environment from a 22 environment is very expensive. And that leads these companies, together with the, you know, headwinds on the consumer side, to essentially embrace an opportunity like consolidation. So in some scenarios, you know, it's a choice where companies see it coming and they say, look, this is probably the strategically better option to go with. And in some scenarios that we also executed on was not really a choice, right? So for the selling company. So, you know, it's the market environment. And so how does the market environment affect, you know, maybe that question is sort of remains unanswered. How does the market environment affect these companies that, you know, marketed themselves as profitable companies to sell? Well, because they may be profitable on the P&L up until EBITDA level, but obviously there is a big interest line item, right? What probably burn rate is for traditional VC, I say traditional VC, VC-backed companies, for us would be sort of how much interest do we pay? And that's sort of the comparison. And so they evaluate that option quite strongly. And that is obviously driven by the massive shift in interest rates. And that is essentially then because of the items that I discussed, technology, size, and scale, and then also trust from, I'd say, the key investor base that is also driving some of that consolidation, benefits Razor Group, also benefits the target company, right? Because, you know, in some cases, you know, they have to do a transaction such as this.
Important dynamic to understand for everybody listening. So I think, because that's often misunderstood, and even like I have friends who are very deeply in this FBA space, and even I sometimes have issues wrapping my hand around this. So therefore, happy to.
So a lot of the music post 2021 in our industry, is happening on the balance sheet. Not necessarily on the P&L, right? So i.e. balance sheet, i.e. sort of, you know, what's your capital structure? You know, what is, you know, how exposed are you to, you know, leverage? And that is driving a lot of the consolidation discussion. What is emerging out of this, obviously, is a clearing of the market. So I'd say this consolidation would have happened anyways, right? But probably if interest rates didn't change as dramatically as they have, it would have taken another 10 years. So what would have happened in 10 years is now essentially happening within a couple of quarters. And that will lead to, I'd say, a more consolidated space. I think, you know, there will be one or two big leaders like Razor Group, I'd say, in quarters from now. Razor Group will definitely be one of them. We are the largest today. And maybe there will be some niche players. But in the long term, and, you know, if we move, there are always two tracks when I speak. There's track one, the capital track, which, you know, sorry, we speak about M&A, we speak about raising debt, we speak about 2021, we speak about the markets change, we speak about consolidation, we speak about, you know, balance sheet versus P&L. That is sort of the capital track. The other track that is obviously incredibly success defining for players in our industry is the consumer track, right? So what's the real world difference that we make? How do we make consumers' lives better, right? Because, you know, just doing M&A into infinity is not where this business is headed. Again, M&A will be a capability, but, you know, the real world delta will happen for consumers by building better consumer products. And, you know, happy to dive deeper on what I mean when I say that. But that's sort of how you have to think about the business, and that's what will drive the consolidation, right? So when we speak about consolidation, M&A, us now consolidating the market, that's a consequence of how capital structures were formed in 2021 and how markets shifted in 2022, and our response and our foresight to be very early as a founding team in communicating, we need to consolidate to emerge as champions. Because before, I'd say most of the players would say, oh, aggregators, it's not winner takes all. It's sort of, you know, you can build your profitable thing and, you know, it's not a race. But I'd say the change in the market environment has made it into winner takes most. Because I'd say the, you know, having a scale and, you know, having all of the items that we discussed, technology, scale, buy-in from the investor base is, I'd say, defining in charting out a successful path ahead. And so I'd say it's when it takes most now, for sure. And so I think for all of those reasons, you know, I think smaller players are compelled to evaluate very strongly whether consolidation makes sense, and if there is a win-win structure that these businesses can find with a player like Razor Group, probably among the very few, if not the only player, to continue to execute on transactions such as these.
When you say leverage is one of the important things to observe at the moment, how exposed is the Razor Group to leverage?
So, of course, Razor Group is also exposed to leverage. You know, we raised a lot of debt. So did, you know, many of the large players, including, you know, Perch Group that we acquired. And so our sort of the conclusion of this entire capital story is obviously the consolidation. And part of the consolidation strategy is obviously to you know, work with the investors on the, I'd say, debt side of the business to, you know, see how we can improve leverage and capital structure with these M&As. So one, you know, one logic and one driver for these consolidation transactions. So we also benefit from consolidation transactions. We are not doing, you know, everybody and anybody a favor and saying, ah, okay, you know, we're the white knight, please come and you know, we'll acquire you. Obviously, our benefit, our advantage, and you know, and so again, that's the capital track of the business, capital structure, M&A.
So that means the money that they raised in debt that was still left?
Yeah.
That was flipped into your equity?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. That's exactly. And so that improved our capital structure, that improved our ratios, our leverage ratios, and essentially built a much more stable platform that's ready for the future. And so when we speak about consolidation, you know, what is driving consolidation? Obviously, us being the better operator. I think the tech piece, we also speak about capital structure. Enhancements, improvements to capital structure via smart structuring of deals, and also obviously revenue synergies and synergies in total. Obviously, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 here. So, you know, these are all of the reasons why it makes a ton of sense in an environment like this you know, to focus on consolidation. We've successfully done that, and you know, that's been probably the reason we are now on a very positive trajectory, despite sort of you know, what the sentiments that you referred to the aggregator space are right now.
One question for my understanding, because I just never thought about this, but so you generally have the cap table of Perch. So when you're merging or you're buying Perch, probably due to the circumstances with shares as well, the cap table merges into your cap table. So they get shares of the Razor Group. If I then flip the debt into Razor equity, it's so that you don't have to pay back the money to the people who lended it to Perch, but they become also like part of the cap table.
They become partners in Prime.
Okay,
essentially.
Yeah? So I'm just needing to understand.
So I'd say the debt providers in Perch are now part of the Razor equity. They think like equity. They want to build a large business. You know, they are. They obviously know the space very well, because they're deployed in many, many different companies. From their perspective, I think it's very important to have a large outcome and a successful outcome. And so that's how they're thinking. And that's how they're supporting the business. And, you know, I think that's one of the key advantages that Razor Group has, which is to have sort of the, you know, lenders as partners kind of tagline. I think that's one of the key advantages that we have post the Perch transaction now. I think strategically that will open a couple of doors for us, hopefully, in the future.
What are other comments that you can openly make about the Perch acquisition?
So, you know, what I'm excited about is, you know, Perch as a business is easily digestible. It is mostly focused on Amazon US. It's quite large in scale. It's a the business is, I'd say, very well run, professionally run, and so our ability to integrate that business is pretty great. So it's pretty easy to integrate. I think that's point one. Point two, you know, there has been some really good talent at Perch. You know, Razor obviously also has great talent, but you know, we are excited to work with some of the key talent at Perch, some of whom are part of Razor leadership now. You know, they have, I'd say, from a cultural perspective, they have thought about the future and sort of our business in a similar way, like Razor Group, as we have. And so that has made the meeting of the minds, I'd say, between different stakeholders, you know, Perch's former CEO, myself, and the wider leadership, very smooth. So I'm excited about that. The thing that I'd say was possibly, you know, that we have to sort of grapple with a little bit, obviously, is the two location piece. You have now many people in Berlin and Boston, and so you know, working across the pond is something that we need to get adjusted to. But you know, we have experience with that because you know, we've had always a big team. Part of our technology team has always sat in India, and so managing across these different time zones, I think is a piece that you know we want to figure out. But I think you know we will.
Would you say after consolidating with Perch, the Razor Group is too big to fail?
Nobody is too big to fail. Nobody is too big. If you have a bad business, you will fail. So nobody is too big to fail. You know, there are things we need to figure out. There are things, you know, there are problem sets we need to solve still. And, you know, we have an excellent team to do so. Look, right now we are well capitalized, and we will seize that opportunity while others are not, and use that capital judiciously and wisely to emerge out of the last leg of the perfect storm as a world-class company. So I think there are things that we can do, we have time to do now, that potentially other players don't. And for us, that will revolve a lot around, you know, the consumer. You know, what can we do on the consumer side? We are very inspired by models like Temu, or, you know, as we look to the east, these C2M models, they're very close to suppliers in the supply chain that have very agile supply chains that respond to customer demands very, very fast. These are models that we are very excited by. So actually, we don't think about our future as Procter & Gamble of the internet. We think that's a very decentralized, fragmented view of the future. It's not like we have 200 brands. That's not how we think about what our business is. We think about our business more on the supply chain, product innovation, product development, deep integration with the supply chain, you know, amazing assortment, amazing price, sort of amazing price value. And value is very important in that equation, not just price. Differentiated product providing to Western consumers. That is sort of where our head is at, and that is sort of what we have executed on very early versus, you know, most of our peers in the last 2 years. And the technology that has come around building sort of a more centralized automated business versus a business that has 200 brands has then allowed us also, that was part of the equation as we thought about, you know, consolidation on the capital side. You know, what we were doing on the consumer, the technology side, how we thought about the business, the nuances about how we thought about the future has been also very helpful and impactful as we had consolidation discussions. Because I think for many of the founders that we spoke to, light bulbs went on. Like, yes, of course, you know, this is a supply chain play. And so our focus very early on, you know, to learn from these Chinese models that are really grabbing shares from important Western e-commerce players, I think has, you know, will define our journey and has defined our journey via consolidation and people, you know, embracing Razor Group and players embracing Razor Group.
So what will be, from a current point of view, and knowing that throughout the years this might change, but because you learn new things, you test things, you build things, what will be the vision for the Razor Group in like 5 to 7 years?
You know, 5 to 7 years is you know, it's a long time out. You know, we have, I think there are a couple of mega trends within consumer that we are excited by, and those guide us as we think about the future. I think one is, you know, I think the West needs a response to players such as Temu and Shein, which we call C2M, vertically integrated businesses. So I think a lot of the innovation in commerce, e-commerce, online commerce, I see in agile supply chains, the ability to serve long-tail customer needs, having the perfect product for each customer, you know, a consumer pulled based assortment versus a supplier pushed based assortment. And so, you know, this is, I think, a key element as we think about the future. Another key element for us, and, you know, I'll use the word aggregation again, but, you know, it's important, is that we fundamentally believe that it's more valuable to consumers to have more merchants that are $100 million in size and less merchants that are $2 to $5 million in size. So I'd say in a couple of years, maybe Amazon already has that realization. If they don't, they'll hopefully come to the realization, you know, it's probably better to have hundreds of thousands, $100 million merchant on their platform and, you know, Walmart and all these other players versus millions of $2 to $5 million merchants, because these larger businesses can be more institutional in what they want to do. They're not about you know, flipping stuff, making a quick buck. And so they will not just arbitrage catalog from Alibaba to Amazon to make quick money, but they will think about, you know, how can we innovate on product level? How can we inject more capital into the supply chains, value chains? How can we build ESG compliant product, right? And so, you know, there is a ton of value to having these larger, you know, e-commerce players, merchants that produce better catalog, produce better assortment. I think that is sort of another big mega trend that we are excited about. The third big mega trend that we are excited about is multi-marketplace. So particularly as you think beyond the West, for example, in Latin America, where we are also operating, but also in Asia, yeah, Shopee, Lazada, Coupang, Rakuten, Flipkart, these are all marketplaces that will grow in size because the underlying economies are growing rapidly. And so if you, on a global scale, while Amazon will continue to be the behemoth that it is, on a relative basis, these marketplaces will become more and more and more important. And so we do see our future, you know, in a multi-marketplace world. Today, you know, our share of Amazon revenues have gone down rapidly because our non-Amazon revenues have expanded so fast.
Where are the current non-Amazon revenues? Is it like online shops? Is it other marketplaces already? Like, where is it?
So what has worked really well for us is obviously, you know, with the acquisition of Valoreo, has been the entire emerging market Mercado Libre channel. In the West, what has surprisingly worked for us has been Walmart as a channel that has scaled rapidly. Yeah, Target in Europe, bol.com in the Netherlands, it's the biggest e-commerce channel in the Netherlands, and the Dutch are very rich, so they have it's a very high margin channel for us. So, you know, there are other opportunities in Europe as well. For example, you have Allegro, you have smaller players in Germany like Otto or Kaufland. But essentially, you know, these top four players, Mercado, Walmart, Target, Bol, has been a source of a lot of growth for us in the last couple of quarters. And then lastly, you know, going back to the mega trends, so we spoke about rise of Chinese vertical e-commerce, C2M models, supply chain. We spoke about consolidation of merchant ecosystem. Yeah, so I also call that the wrong Darwinism of the marketplace, right? Which is, you know, the idea that a super fragmented merchant ecosystem is more valuable than a more consolidated ecosystem. I think there is, you know, a middle ground where, you know, you have fragmentation, but you have individually larger merchants that will produce more value than a super hyper fragmented merchant ecosystem through, you know, injection of capital in the supply chain, all the things that we mentioned. Third was multi-marketplace. And I'd say the fourth mega trend that we see in Asia, it has not caught on in the West, but it is now increasingly with TikTok shops, is video. And so these are the four mega trends that we are excited about within consumer. And I think each one of them, you know, it can be a big enough topic, but I think the combination of the four and, you know, bringing them together thoughtfully is where I see our future more operationally, you know. And you can summarize this, we like to summarize this as the Western response to C2M models like Temu and Shein. But, you know, I think it's more nuanced than that. Yeah.
From a marketplace dynamic, I think, or I would say that more competition, even when it's super frequented, challenges all players to an extent that it still increases a lot of value for the customer.
I think, you know, that logic obviously is the simple logic that would make sense, right? So in the economics 101 class, more fragmentation means better value to consumers. But I think at certain scale, which is, you know, sub $5 million, you can't do the same things as you can do as being a $100 million business. And so what we see actually in that segment of merchant size is that the quality of product that is being sourced is more like stuff flipped from the vendor. So, you know, you go onto Alibaba, you go for the first best product. You contact the vendor, probably sits in China. You source the product and you arbitrage that product to Amazon or Walmart, whatever channel, e-commerce channel that you end up using. Now, that arbitraging opportunity, which I call arbitrage Alibaba to Western e-commerce marketplaces, that sort of alpha margin that intelligent entrepreneurs have used in the last 10 years, I think that's gone. And so really what you need to focus on is product IP, right? So today, a lot of the product IP through that mechanism of FBA entrepreneurs at scale, you know, getting goods from China and selling them on Amazon lies in China. And so moving that product IP back to the West, i.e. the innovation and building an institution around creating great consumer products and injecting the required capital in product development and, you know, the required working capital into the supply chain is something that $100 million businesses can do much better and therefore provide much better value to end consumer. And so that's why I refer to, I'd say, the wrong conclusion of, you know, many is better for end consumer as sort of the wrong Darwinism, where a false kind of Darwinism where you say, okay, I have millions of merchants. If that customer doesn't work, I'll just have another customer. If this merchant doesn't work, I'll just have another merchant, killing that merchant, providing that same product. But what that results in is really products without innovation. So, you know, what your suggestion results in the future is just not great consumer products. And we see from our data that actually there is precedent to generate a lot of margin on Amazon. So contrary to common belief, I think if you find the right PMF, product market fit at product level, you know, customers are willing to pay, and you're able to build quite profitable, you know, consumer products that you can sell to end consumer if they're thoughtful, if they're differentiated, if they have the right design element. And so, you know, that's a core focus for us, adding that product IP, adding that design element to consumer products globally.
Just to understand the catalog better, how many or approximately how many SKUs do you have in Razor Group?
So we are retailing globally probably, you know, 40,000 different products.
Does it mean that you have to find the right level of product innovation and product market fit for like 40,000 individual products?
No, you know, I think, you know, within the catalog, obviously you have products that are, you know, it's sort of similar to retail, where, you know, obviously we're a tech business, but, you know, you can draw learnings from retail wherein, you know, there is a fat head that is generating a lot of the, you know, the EBITDA and the revenues. And then there is sort of a long tail of product that, you know, you could use to innovate, to test. Some of them are at the end of the product life cycle. So, you know, managing this 40,000 SKUs, you know, that happens through technology and automation. And so technology and automation is a key requirement to operating these businesses and keep on also consolidating our peers if we choose to. At this stage, you know, we may not choose to. I think we have now reached really a comfortable spot from where we may just focus on driving our C2M strategy. Yeah, so, yeah.
Additionally, I would say, like, nothing to do with your SKUs, more on the, because we talked about product quality. When I look at Temu and Shein, and then we can definitely question if their model provides the best quality for consumers at the moment.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do you plan on adapting or finding the answer to what those companies are doing by providing better quality?
So I think, you know, there are things that companies like Temu and Shein are obviously not as good at. But what is undeniable is that they're grabbing market share. Yeah, it's undeniable. And that is not just a consequence of higher marketing spend. You know, they're doing something fundamentally different, that global capital is finding their ways to cap tables of these companies, including one of the, you know, most sophisticated or the most sophisticated investors globally, such as Sequoia. China is probably invested in Shein. I'm not sure if they are, but, you know, 80% guess they are. So what are these companies doing different? And, you know, where is opportunity to beat these companies? So I definitely think sort of in, you know, in the last mile, in the sort of product quality, sort of being perceived or being sort of more compliant, you know, and just being higher quality, I think is an area where probably they have still not done such a great job, and it's an area of opportunity to improve for somebody like Razor Group. But where they are doing an amazing job, and, you know, we just need to appreciate that, is, you know, their core strength is in supply chain sort of response times, product innovation cycles, understanding what customers want, and then providing customers with what they want. I always like to say internally, think about a landing page where you can just serve the exact product that a customer wants in that point of time. And that is sort of, you know, something that, you know, we take inspiration from. Obviously, we're a much smaller player than Shein and Temu today. Pinduoduo, the holding company of Temu, is one of the largest e-commerce companies in the world. Probably a crazy case study that we need to learn from. I think it's good to learn also from the East, not only from the West. But, you know, overall, that's something that we're excited by. There are obviously things that they're doing not as great, and there is a perception, and probably founded in reality, of drawbacks of these Chinese players. But there are great things that they do that we need to learn from, and things that they're not as good at, you know, we need to see if we can improve them. And then, you know, we have a shot in the West to, you know, build something similar or even different and beat them.
Quick addition to the Shein cap table: Sequoia Capital China, General Atlantic, Tiger Global Management, IDG Capital, Javco Asia, and Greenwoods Asset Management.
Yeah.
So therefore, I think they raised more than $4 billion.
Yeah. So you have it. So, you know,
one more question. I think one of the last points that we will cover, but you have 40,000 SKUs. You bought like a lot of different brands throughout the years. Either you bought the brand directly, or you bought other companies that bought many brands. So you have like a lot of different brands. You could do pretty much like, in quotation marks, the everything brand and call it like Razor and sell everything under Razor, or build different sub brands, and or you let all of them be the single brands that they were. How do you think about the brand strategy for the future?
So brand is very important, because brand allows us to cater to consumers in a better way. And P&L is just a consequence of that. I don't like brand because it means better margin. I like brand because it serves customer needs better. It, you know, provides a signal. However, as we sort of connect the idea of brand to our roll-up, 2021 roll-up strategy, and also now consolidation, I think what players around the space need to realize, and are increasingly realizing, is that the FBA assets that we acquired, you know, some of them are brands. A large portion of those are not brands. And so I would rather title the FBA assets that we acquired as catalog of products with high PMF, product market fit, because they're selling at immense scale. Customers love them versus other products. So there's immense customer love for those products. And some of the FBA assets that we acquired obviously are brands, where actually you have customers searching on Amazon for the brand name and then making the purchase versus searching for a non-branded keyword and then making the purchase based on sort of superiority of product. Our brand strategy is, you know, as we develop this C2M retail machine, which is more centralized versus a Procter & Gamble. A Procter & Gamble is not as centralized as a Procter & Gamble. And that's why I don't like the comparison to Procter & Gamble, because Procter & Gamble is like 10 brands that are each billions of dollars in scale. Their biggest sort of capability is top of funnel marketing. Our biggest capability is supply chain, value chain, innovation, product. So, you know, I think the company that we orient ourselves, that we get inspiration from, are the Chinese companies on the supply chain side, maybe not on the consumer side, you know, in the perception of quality, et cetera. That's something that I think we can do much better versus those players, but certainly on the supply chain side.
So I would argue that, Braun, for example, owned by Procter & Gamble, is very good on the product side as well.
Yeah, they're obviously, so but but there's a difference, because for Braun, it's just essentially one SKU, one product with different variations, right? And so the supply chain capability required to have Braun on the supply chain side is very standardized. You always need the same sort of components. The supply chain capability that you need for a business like Razer with 40,000 different SKUs with ASPs from $15 to $50, yeah, versus Braun, I don't know, is $100 or $200 maybe, you know, that kind of range. And the width of the catalog and the different kind of products is an entirely different supply chain capability. Every sales press. It's an entirely different supply chain capability. So while you could say, yes, they're great at product, of course they're great at product. Otherwise, why, you know, they need to be great at product, not just marketing. But their key capability is the customer communication piece. And then, supply chain piece is their product piece sort of meets what they communicate. But it's sort of like it's marketing, top of funnel, storytelling first, right? And for us, you know, it is, you know, automating a behemoth of a supply chain. And that is our key differentiator as we look towards the future. Notice how we're not speaking about M&A at all right now, right? And those are the conversations I'd love to have. You know, and I hope increasingly in the next couple of quarters and years, we can speak about consumer supply chain product more than the next consolidation. I think aggregation, again, is a strategy. Consolidation is a strategy. Consolidation has been a response to the market environment, which for every e-commerce company has been what it is. But our future, and you know, consumer will be the happy child again. I can guarantee you. I don't know when it's going to be for capital markets. Is it a year, 2 years, half a year? I don't know. Consumers is going to be the happy child again, and when it does, you know, we'll have a, you know, large scale business with amazing consumer products. We'll be the only response to Temu and Shein, and who knows, maybe we'll reach the end consumer via video commerce as well at some point, right? So this is sort of the vision we are executing towards. Certainly have the time to execute towards that vision, and I think we're making great progress.
I think that's a good point to end the conversation. I am very thankful that you took the time for coming to the show and explaining all of your thoughts, experiences, and great to see or hear more than just headlines that are written by some people assuming stuff. So having somebody who explains a lot of thoughts makes it easier to have your own opinion. And yeah, I think probably we'll find some time at some point to discuss how the products and supply chain innovations are going onward and how it's developing. So I wish you all the best for the future. And
thank you for having me.
Of course, I'll link to your LinkedIn in the show notes, but happy to hand over the last words of the podcast that you can.
So, I mean, you know, First of all, thank you for having me. Thank you for having this podcast in English. I'm sure that, you know, everybody at Razor will appreciate if they can actually follow what we're discussing. Even, you know, a large part of our people in the Berlin office are probably English first. So thank you very much for that. Third, I'd say, look, you know, we discussed sort of the entrepreneurial journey with capital, without capital. There is no one size fits it all answer. I think everybody has to figure out, based on context of their own context, what path they want to go on. Sometimes paths are open, sometimes they're not. If a door is open that you feel great about, go through that door. I think that's probably the advice that I can give. There are not many doors in life. You know, how you make that decision, whether that's analysis or gut or whatever, you know, I think if there is a great door, take that door, whether that's with capital or without capital, you know, doesn't really matter. It's just take that door, move forward, progress, and become a better person and build great businesses.
Tushar, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. Yeah.